So, welcome to Brunchworks Episode 2, a podcast about design thinking and making change happen. We are Ryan Cole
and Mary Doucet,
and we want to help you use the power of human-centered design to empower you with creative confidence. Whether you're creating an iPhone app or an educational process, we're all creators, and there are tools and processes that we can all use to inform our work. Design thinking is one of the most powerful. On the first episode, we discovered the design thinking process, and today we'll dig a little bit deeper into the first stage, which is called empathy or discovery. We've also got Ming Li on the show, a self-professed geek who puts people before technology, and he's going to share with us his expertise on user research and user experience design. So, to get started, Marie, can you refresh us on what the design thinking process looks like?
So, the design thinking process consists of first empathy or discovery stage. Then we need to define a problem or a point of view. Thirdly, it's all about idea generation. And finally, prototyping and testing. And the whole process can be repeated as long as necessary.
Today we'll talk about the first stage of the design process, which is empathy. So why is empathy important in the design process? What kind of understanding does this enable you to get as a designer?
Well, I think it's all about making good design. For me, like, good design means that we create something which is viable, which serves business, which is desirable, means that it will serve humans or people, and which is technically feasible. And empathy is all about starting with a desire, with making something that people will want and that will be useful for them. It's also about designing something that makes sense, that will be useful, but that creates an experience that goes beyond form and function. So in the end, it's like making something which will be truly innovative and not just incrementally, but in a radical way.
So traditionally, the design process involves steps which are similar to this, although I think there's like a big gap when it comes to iteration and involving the user in design decisions. Traditionally, the designer is sort of the god of the process who, through his or her experience and intuition, is able to make decisions about what works and what doesn't work. And the biggest difference between the traditional design process and the human-centered design process is that with the traditional design process, you're not able to reliably generate innovation because you're basically limited to the experience of the single designer and you're not opening yourself up to input from your end users. And like Marie said, it leads to incremental improvements where we're basically taking an existing idea or concept and sort of, you know, making small bits of it better here or there.
Yeah. For example, adding a feature, changing colors, changing material, right, or just reacting.
Improving performance. Yeah. Right, reactive design, basically. Even if the design is good, and even if you are incrementally improving something, it can still fail to create real value because you're never directly involving the needs or problems of the people you're trying to design for. So this traditional design process involves a few steps. You want to take us through that, Marie?
Yeah. So usually in my design process, I start always with research, which can be research about competitors, research about existing products, like doing a benchmark, and identifying trends. Then I'm collecting this inspiration into mood boards, which can be about colors, materials, feelings. And that's when we get to rely often on the muse, that once we got this research, say, okay, we put it aside, say, research is done, let's get inspired.
Yeah? And then it's magic.
And the magic happens. Or not. We also, designers also analyze technological options, which can be referred to technological push, and try to integrate what the marketing department wants, which can be described by marketing pull. And there's a compromise between those two things. And we try to integrate this technology information, marketing information, into what is going to be the product or service.
And so the human-centered design process is based on this traditional process because that's where it comes from. But instead of being this kind of straightforward, I am the designer, I make the final decision, way of approaching, take it or leave it approach, there's a heavy user focus, which is kind of built into the entire process.
Yeah, and this user focus like can be either in online. I mean, I think today with social media, we have access to so many users and who are just telling, like, willingly what they think about products and services. But more interestingly, it can happen also in real life, and I think that's what we're going to focus on today. That instead of imagining some personas or characters and saying, okay, this person, my ideal user is 30 years old, 2 kids, stay-at-home mom, we can actually go and meet this person and see what they really need. So in the human-centered process, we try to frame this inspiration from the point of view of the user. We gather some insights from the user research again that will influence our design decisions. And it's a very iterative process that is involved in all project phases. It's not just like research at the beginning of a project, and say, okay, we've done it, that's it. But it's something we come back and come back to improve the designs at all phases. So from the beginning, sketching, we can test it, prototyping, testing again, gathering some insights, redefining problems, and so on. So how to use this human-centered design?
Right. So I think this is where a lot of people who are otherwise interested in this process kind of get stuck. Because there's a lot of information out there about, saying user research is really important, your users are really important, you need to think about your users. And then there's this sort of leap that you need to make where you actually have to put these things into action. And I think this is the hard step for most people. So we've kind of put together a little step-by-step guide for how you can take these theories, basically, and put them into actual practice. So the first step would be to define your users.
So, yes, you start by a kind of user profile or ideal customer profile. But this is defined with contact, after contact with real people. So, yes, I would say, yes, I'm interested in serving mothers with 2 kids, but I'm sure actually going to meet this person. So once I've defined some personas, I will try to get their story, to get to know how they relate to the product in details, and getting their feelings and emotions relating to the service or product. Another way to find users is to look at edge cases or extreme users, which we then define again by meeting them. These extreme users are often experts in a certain domain, or on the opposite, they have very limited abilities in what we want to achieve. For example, we're talking about a computer or network manager at a school that could inform us on how computers are actually used in the school, what function they want, and so on, what are their experience of it. Yeah? So now we've talked about end users, but I think there are also many people who are involved with the product and services as non-direct users, let's say. People who are doing the maintenance, who are producing the actual pieces, who are selling the product. So it's really great to go and talk with them or follow them. Now, the question is, how many people do you actually need to get a good sample? Contrary to scientific method, you don't need that to actually 100 or 1 to 1,000 people. If you get as small as 3 to 8 to 10 users, you can already gather enough information to create a meaningful product.
So how can you take this knowledge of people and transform this into actionable criteria that you can use in a design process?
Yeah, so for this, there are different methods. I think we can define three axes. Yeah? First is to be the customer, to really be in their shoes. For example, buy your own product, try your own call center, these kind of things. Second axis would be to watch the customer, to observe him or her. And this can be done in an online way or in person. And then if you get really brave, and I think that's the best way to really go into details, into the stories, emotions, and so on, you should talk with your customers. So what concrete methods we can use for that? I think that we've talked about user data last time, gathering data, web analytics, sales, going onto forums and so on. That's good for a start. It's like a way to not take too much risks, let's say. But even better is to get out of the office. So you could start with a one-to-one interview, one-on-one interview, and just ask questions, and as much as possible, keep open questions and listen, and be careful to not influence the answers, to not orient too much, you know. And I think these interviews are much better than surveys, because you can do a survey, you can gather data and so on, but it gets very easily impersonal and rarely reflect reality, that people will often lie or omit
right.
real stuff.
Or even a lot of times the way people will describe things of their own behavior are not actually even true.
Yeah.
A lot of times people sort of have an idealized version of how they actually behave.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And quite often I see we just did some questionnaire at school about the different topics or subjects which are taught. And you can see that most of the comments are very negative. So the question is, are only the bad students answering? Or are the classes that bad? Yeah.
Right.
So it can be easily biased.
Right.
Talking about watching the customers, there is a technique called user shadowing, which is a day in the life of your user. So it means to get in their life. It's a bit more intrusive, let's say, where you pick up your user and you will follow them wherever they go, from early morning to late evening, to really share their life and their context. And so it means like having breakfast with them, going to work with them, following them even in activities which are non-product related. So Ryan, you had a nice example about this.
Right. We were sort of talking before this podcast about how this user shadowing can be really important for establishing context of your user. So, you know, an interview can be really, really useful because you can sit down with a user face-to-face and you can say, how do you think about your email application? And they can take you through and they can show you how they use email. But what you're missing there is the real context. You know, do they come to the office and first thing they do, open a browser tab and, like, you know, open Gmail? Are they checking this, like, while they're getting jostled around inside the subway? So for an example, me and my wife use WhatsApp Messenger a lot to communicate just throughout the day, little messages. I'm going to pick up the kids, or can you get some milk? And a lot of times, because we have two small kids, a lot of times she's chasing around a small child. So she doesn't have two hands free to, you know, type on a fiddly little iPhone screen. So WhatsApp's got this really cool feature where you can hold down a microphone icon and actually just record a voice memo and then release the button and it's automatically sent. So she uses this all the time. For her, it's really convenient because she doesn't have to type anything. She doesn't have to worry about, you know, proofreading goofy, like, speech-to-text interpretation of what she says. She can just kind of rattle off what's on her mind and then send it. But from my point of view, it's actually kind of inconvenient pretty regularly because I'm not always in a situation where I can receive an audio message. So a lot of times, you know, I'll be in a class lecture with students, or I'm in a meeting or some other context where if it was text-based, I could easily flip my phone open and at least receive the information, maybe not respond. But when it's audio, I really can't in certain contexts. Even if you're sitting, you know, in the office with your coworkers around, you could play it, but then, you know, do you really want everyone listening to your wife's message yelling at you about why you didn't buy milk in the morning?
So it's actually great, like, this kind of observation serves you,
right?
Gives you, like, an opportunity for design.
To discover these things.
Yes.
Because, you know, without that context, you would look at that feature and say, like, oh, wow, it's a great convenience, you know, because you're viewing it only from the sender's point of view. But if you had the context also of the receiver, you know, maybe you could make the conclusion that it would be handy to have a feature where you could translate that audio back to text,
mm-hmm.
Or something like that. But context can really make the difference between having something which meets a user's need as they describe the need, And something which is really kind of amazing for the user.
Absolutely, yes. And to go more in detail into that, when you are interviewing somebody or watching them, there's different ways to observe and different things to look at. First thing is listen to what the user says. So I think that this is quite obvious and easy to do. Then you need to check, to watch them, to watch how they use the product, what they are doing. So this, and this can be also done by having the user thinking aloud. Yeah. Then the next possibility or next point of view, let's say, is to try to get in their head.
Right, to empathize.
Yes. Yes. And to get to know what are they thinking when they are saying and doing that. Because they can say you something, but think about something else.
Right, right.
Or do something, and actually they would like to do something totally different.
Right.
Yeah. And this is achieved by asking often why. Why are you doing that? Oh, and reacting again, say, okay, if you do that, why, and why, and why? And it can get quite emotional, but I think this is when you know that you've hit some interesting points.
And this is also how like, four-year-olds approach the world, right?
Yeah.
Like, mommy, why is the door open that way?
Yeah.
Because it can't open the other way. Why can't it open the other way? Because it can't open the other way.
and actually, like, some things might feel obvious for us, like,
right.
Why the sky is blue. We don't think about those things, but here it's about challenging your assumption and being open to new stuff.
So it's almost like psychotherapy.
Maybe it's part of it. I mean, I think if you're a good psychiatrist or psychologist, it can help you to make better interviews, yeah? So as part of this empathy roadmap, you listen to what people say, you watch what they do, you try to get into their head what they think, and finally, you see what they feel. So you extrapolate from the previous information more into the emotions, into the stories, and seeing like how they feel right now, but also how they would like to feel in a prospective kind of way. And I think this is where you can get the best insights.
Right.
And start doing like interesting work.
So now we have a pretty good breakdown on the steps involved in starting this user-centered design process, some methods that you can use in order to get access to your users' feelings and thoughts and actions, and as well as a tool, we can use this empathy map to really kind of quantify almost our experiences that we're, the insight that we're getting from the user. So if I would like to implement this, how would I get started?
Well, there's one exercise I do quite often with students, which is called a gift-giving exercise, which was developed by Stanford Design School. It's a Creative Commons document. And the starting point is that students or anybody like has to redesign the gift-giving experience. I think the important word is experience. We don't just design a gift, a physical object, but we design the whole experience behind it, around it, everything which is related to that. So first thing I ask students to do is just to interview each other and just ask, when was the last time you got a gift? Yeah. How did you feel? What made this experience like positive? Or what was difficult? Did you have any pain or suffering? And from that, we define a point of view, or we try to get together some insights. So, for example, somebody might say, oh, it's so difficult to find the right gift that fits for the right persons. And if you give gifts again and again, you're like, okay, sometimes you miss inspiration, or you will give something that is not satisfying.
Or you give something that's totally out of proportion for the event.
Also, there's a thing about Christmas shopping, gift giving. For many people, it can feel really as a pressure,
mm-hmm.
something that you must do. And the actual act of shopping, if you shop with a partner or friends, not everybody is enjoying it as much as the others. So how do you make it enjoyable for more people? Then there is also the question of shared gifts. If you're a group of friends making a common gift for somebody, you need to agree on something,
coordinate,
put the money together, pay back the person who is actually purchasing the gift, and still make it personalized, show that, yes, I took part in this, not just with my money, but also with my emotion. So actually, like, even with something as simple as that, we can unearth many needs, and each of these needs is an opportunity for design.
So now we're going to jump to our interview with Ming Li, who has over 12 years of experience in lots of different places.
Including Nokia.
Including Nokia in Finland. And he, I would say, is highly knowledgeable about this user research process. So let's jump into that. So here with us today is Ming Li. He's a lead user researcher, UX designer, with experience ranging from startups to multinationals like Nokia, a geek who puts people before technology. So Ming's lived in a lot of different places, which I think gives him a really interesting kind of point of view on user experience design and user research.
So Ming, tell us, like, this is the official bio, so tell us a bit more, like, about yourself and maybe something more personal. Maybe. Who are you?
Yeah, well, I can just give a little bit of background. I started using computers as a teenager. You know, Mum brought home a computer one day. You know, this was in the old days when there were, you know, two floppy drives on it. No hard drive.
And a dial-up modem, maybe.
That's right. Oh, we bought the dial-up modem.
Is it external box?
300 baud. That's 300 bytes per second, is it?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, so I basically taught myself how to use that, together with the help of friends, of course. But I always saw my mum had a lot of difficulties with it. And I thought, and I remember thinking as a child that it shouldn't be like this from a really early age.
Okay, that was sort of your first impetus into understanding usability.
Yeah, I basically saw my mum saying that she's stupid, and I thought, you're not actually, you're really intelligent. You're a law librarian. I mean, you're not stupid. There's something going on here that's not right.
Right.
So I followed the information technology scene as it was at the time, and I studied information technology, but I was a little bit different to the other people. They all took free electives in economics, and I took my free electives and did social studies. So I always had this bent towards the more human side of things. And, that actually led me to leave Australia because I wanted to do some other studies. So I pretty much completed my IT degree and then went to Canada to study, just for fun, anthropology and linguistics, just for 1 year, just to round off my studies.
Mm-hmm. As we do.
Yeah.
And that started my overseas odyssey.
And so you lived in Finland for quite a long time as well, right?
Yeah, 13 years.
Yeah, So you speak Finnish.
Kyllä.
Mean on.
And so what was your... And so in Finland you were working for Nokia.
Yeah.
And you were working on specific products?
So I was actually in this... user experience concept design team, and that was a central team, and we would go and work in different parts of Nokia wherever user experience work was required. So I've worked, like, on Nokia.com for the marketing team, so our main website, and on internal human resources systems, and then some of the really interesting stuff was for NRC, the research center, Nokia Research Center. Mm-hmm. Working on new user interface paradigms for, you know, maybe coming out in 5 years' time.
Okay.
And also on just some applications and the consumer or
that's,
internal.
That's cool. So you probably have, as a UX person, probably have a much different experience coming into UX than most people listening. If you're a UX professional, you're probably more of a freelancer or working in smaller teams. So you probably have, like, kind of a unique experience of being inside of a big company with kind of a mobile division who can move around and work on a lot of different stuff. So it's kind of like interesting perspective.
Yeah, it's really nice. I guess you had the support, but at the same time, the flexibility to try different projects.
Yeah, yeah, a lot of different projects. So both enterprise side and the consumer side, right. And then these research, which is looking far off into the future.
Mm, that's cool.
And of course, when you work in, say, a big company, there's access to resources that you have.
Yeah. Right.
Good, but there's also certain red tape.
Sure, yeah. Of course.
Yes.
Yeah. Of course.
So if we go back to the basics, like what is really user research and user experience? Like what is that you do?
Yeah, so I've been polishing that script for a long time about how to explain to people what my job is.
It's a tough one, yeah.
And I think my objective is basically to make technology easier for people to use, mm-hmm. and it should support their needs. I basically see that the user experience industry, if you want to call it that, is very close to what an architect is.
Yeah.
So a good architect, say you're building a house for a family.
Good architect.
A good architect. This isn't public, is it? This recording. I mean, I think a good architect would be with the family and ask, you know, what they do, how many kids do they have or they're thinking of having, and do they think they'll work from home or what are the things they'll do at home? And then with that, you can design, you know, how the house should support the activities of the family and the lifestyle.
Yeah. I've never heard of an architect working that way. Maybe there are some.
Many architects work more with their ego, and mm-hmm. I guess that's not the way you see it.
Right.
But I understand as well that architecture is like, or being an architect is more as like being a conductor of an orchestra, that you are taking pieces from different places and putting it together. And of course, listening to people who will live in the house is super, super important. And could you tell us like a bit more in depth why we should really care of user research? Because I think many companies do lots of products, but maybe they don't do that user research. So what does it bring? What are the benefits of doing user research?
Yeah. So we talked about what user experience is. Maybe I can also then give you my view on what user research
yes.
is. So to me, it's that part where the architect is then talking to the family mm-hmm. and finding out what their needs are.
Yes.
I actually try to avoid this term research because people get really scared by it. They start thinking of academic
yes.
research, where projects are usually at least 6 months, and you've got to do it really rigorous because mm-hmm. it's all peer-reviewed. And, well, sorry to say, but the state of the IT industry is at such a low level in terms of the user experience that you actually don't need to do much at all.
To make it better.
To make it better.
Right.
So
and I think also maybe it's not even just that that's the state of the industry. I think it's just that it's generally a step which is looked over, like in most forms of design probably. And yes. so at that point, like, yeah, like you're saying, any research is better than no research.
Mm. And actually this gets back to your point on, you know, ego.
Yes.
And, like, the famous architects that you tend to know about are those who've won some prizes. And they've won those prizes by doing radically different things, mm-hmm. which may look really great, and maybe some of them are really usable, but maybe some of them are just different to be different to right. win that competition.
Yeah, I have a story about that. I used to work at the Modern, which is a modern art museum in Fort Worth, Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And an amazing building was designed by Tadao Ando, actually.
Oh, I love him.
Yeah, so this is a story you'll enjoy hearing then. But basically, he's this sort of big brand name architect, and he has like a very specific style. And where I'm from in North Texas, we have really unpredictable weather. And so, you know, right now, just looking at the weather, what it's like right now in the sort of early spring, last week it was in the low 70s, and this week it's like everything's covered in ice. And we have tornadoes, and we have giant hail, and this kind of stuff. And so what he wanted to do was just a giant glass box with, like, concrete boxes inside that would basically protect the artwork from sunlight. And it was months of back and forth of the curator saying, like, yeah, well, that's really, like, interesting design, but it's not going to work for us because we have, like, this really kind of dramatic weather. And he's saying, like, oh, it's not a problem, it's not a problem. And then he was actually there one time for a meeting, and we had one of these sort of catastrophic hailstorms where everyone's, like, panicking and driving their cars under overpasses to, like, get them out of the hail. And literally hailstones, which are probably 3-4 inches across. And they just took him outside, and he was like, oh.
Yeah, but, so, which is great. Like you said, it just took him outside. And I think that's one big part of your work, is to get people outside of their office.
And just understanding and the actual context,
yes,
right?
Yes.
Yeah, and this actually gets into the deep reasons as to why the IT industry has produced... It's really productive. They've produced an enormous amount of things. But out of those, mm-hmm. you know, out of those, you know, there are million. There's a million apps on Apple iTunes Store and on Google Play each,
right?
Which is a huge number. But out of those, how many are actually useful and how many are easy to use?
Double decimal points.
And the reason for this is to do actually with this designing, say, for yourself, or basically not designing for the person who's going to use it.
Exactly.
It goes back to the old days when I was starting to use computers, and it was only hobbyists, and
right.
hobbyists would have a real interest in learning mm-hmm. about how to use a computer and spend hours, you know, trying to work out how to do something, and they would also make things for themselves.
Right.
When you make something for yourself, of course, you know how it works.
Right.
But if you make it for somebody else, there's now this gap that you need to bridge.
Right, and especially with personal computers, I think in the very beginning it was such a kind of radically new technology that people just assumed that it had to be difficult because it was high tech and it was just something you had to dump hours into learning. And so there wasn't an expectation that it would be easy to use. Whereas I think now we're like a bit spoiled where we expect everything to be easy to use, so the bar is much higher.
But actually, I think it's great. I wouldn't say spoiled.
Sure,
I think this is a really good thing for the industry where
right.
consumers won't put up with poor user experiences anymore,
right.
and they'll just go to another app or go to another website.
Yeah,
I think that's a
great thing.
Getting
more and more demanding, so we just have to keep up with it.
Right, and I think there's also kind of an interesting thing happening here. Like at the moment, we have this push for simplicity.
Mm.
You know, like everything is about simplifying, and I think it, like this pattern works really well when it's kind of a straight consumer-facing product. You know, if you're making, like, the Vine app, then, of course, you need, like, one button where you, like, record a video and then upload it. But if you're creating something which is more for kind of expert users, then the context is different, and simplicity probably is not the best approach.
And I think it's not necessarily just for expert users, but if you design a service, it gets already much more complex because you have so many stakeholders and
right.
the person who makes the thing, who is, mm-hmm. like, in contact with the customer, like, there's different... interaction there, and each of them needs to be designed
right.
in an ideal.
Right, area. And I think this sort of reduction of simplicity also tends to kind of fall back into this kind of pattern of ego design, where it's like, you know, maybe you feel like you don't need to do user testing because you've simplified it to the point where there's like it's not possible to be confused.
Yeah, maybe I can take those 2 points. So that when you're designing like for experts, like say enterprise systems,
mm-hmm,
which can be quite complicated, one reason that they are complicated is maybe because the business processes that they need to support are complicated. So it's really important to actually take that other view and say that's what I see service design is. It's basically the same principle as user experience, but maybe looking at a more holistic view. And I think then, I've seen this many times, you don't want to automate stuff that was a mess, because then you just have more mess. It's just digitized.
And mess that no one understands anymore.
Exactly. So actually when you do these, say, enterprise things and consumer things, it's actually important to take a step back and look at the processes. Do we even need this step, for example? And if you can get rid of the step, then that's great for everybody. The programmer doesn't even have to make anything
right.
anymore for that. So I see this really goes together. And on the consumer side, naturally then, if you focus on one area, you need to focus on that and keep it simple. But there's a very big competitive pressure, or perceived competitive pressure, that you need to keep adding features. Because when you go to a review website, what do? They have a table there. Tick, 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 tick.
Right.
you know, has this feature, has this feature.
And then you get Adobe Photoshop after 25 years.
That's right. It's feature artists. Actually, Donald Norman writes about it in his book.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some really interesting way to work against it, which is to look at what is this true strength of your product. And what's this? You know, what's the focus of your vision of your company?
Right.
And focus really on that and making your product special in that area.
Right, and not sort of like you said, giving into that pressure to like our competitor does this thing, so we had to do this thing too.
Because the actual end result of this is that all the products begin to look the same,
and they're all equally horrible to use.
Exactly, because if you put lots of things into one thing, it's complicated to use. It's like my phone.
Mm-hmm.
I do use it as a camera a lot because it's handy to carry. I don't have to carry another camera. But compared to my old, you know, Canon PowerShot, it's still in the dust, this Galaxy phone.
Yeah.
Because my Canon, I can pull it out, I can turn it on, I know it's going to go on straight away. It's not just going to freeze, you know, a little bit while it's thinking. And I can press that shutter button and I'll take the picture.
Yeah.
So it's like, why is a hammer so easy to use? Because it does
one thing. Maybe two.
Maybe, yeah, maybe remove the nails too. But, you know, it's very simple. Yeah.
Unless you're counting blunt injury trauma. So do you have any examples of projects you've worked on where there's been, like, a great success or a great failure or something notable that you think would be interesting for our listeners?
Yeah. From a success point of view, there was a project that I really... really enjoyed working on, and we also had really good results. I mean, it's good to have both.
Yeah.
And this was to make a video sharing service for a very large company. And the keys to how this worked was basically, when I look back on the project, was that there were only four core people. There was the project manager, there was me as the UX researcher and designer, there was a programmer and a tester, and we worked really closely together. We had a crazy deadline to meet, but we managed to, you know, we worked on the concepts together with stakeholders, developing, you know, what is it they actually want to achieve, what are the business objectives that they want to achieve, and what should be in it for the actual users of the system, why should they want to share a video, for example. And we focused on those. And because we only had a short space of time, it actually had to be simple.
Mm-hmm.
So we just focused on what are the essentials. And we created then that system within a very short space of time. But as far as I understand, it still continues to this day to serve, you know, to serve the user base that it was created for well. And people have written back, giving very good feedback, that the user experience is very good. And in this, I see the success comes from us working very closely together.
Right.
You know, you never design something in isolation.
Mm-hmm.
When you make a design, there's the people not only who use it, but there's the person who creates it, who actually builds it. That's the programmer or the software engineer.
Right.
These days they're called developers, then they keep changing. But, yeah, and we had a very good relationship. So if he says, okay, Ming, this will take me, you know, quite a significant amount of time to make, then I can say, all right, well, let's see maybe we can change things a bit here,
mm-hmm.
while still keeping a good user experience.
Right.
So I think this close communication and collaboration is actually then the key to...
Right.
And in that project, there was some time to, you know, make some paper prototypes, which is basically once the screen designs are done, print them out, and then I take them to some less technical people, and I just see what they think about it, ask them to try out some things. And just that small, you know, that was, what, maybe half a day's effort, that you already get feedback, you can feed that into the
right.
design.
It's,
yeah, and this is actually what I like people to understand, that doing user research, it doesn't have to be this big, heavy thing. Sometimes it needs to be because you've got a question for which there really aren't many answers at the
mm-hmm.
moment, or it's hard to get those answers, but... if you need feedback on your design, there's many ways to get that with a small amount of effort.
Right. Right. And we talked a little bit in the segment earlier about considering who the users of your product are. And we're kind of talking earlier in a kind of more broad sense of product. You know, so now we're kind of talking mostly about software product, but we were talking previously about, you know, designing a service or designing a physical object, and also considering people, not only the end user, but also people in the pipeline of your product. You know, so if you're designing a physical product, the people who are making it, you know, considering the manufacturing processes.
Yeah, people who would do the maintenance or the call centers, like
right.
a helpline and this kind of stuff. So it's not just end user. There's
right.
so many people involved there.
And then the people have to sell it for you as
yeah.
well.
Mm-hmm.
If the people who sell it aren't on your side,
exactly.
you won't get
most
the sales.
Sell anything.
Yeah.
I mean, if you want to tie it to sort of a digital product context, you know, if you're designing a website, you're designing the website for, you know, the readers, the people who are consuming the content, but also for the people who have to use the content management system every day. You know, it may be actually even more for those people because those are the copy editors or, you know, contract authors who are writing and have to go into the, you know, the actual content management system and understand what certain form fields do and how those things translate to the actual product. So,
and I think you bring up a very good point here that often this is forgotten. I can remember so many times when I worked for particularly large companies, for example, where we would put some effort into the end user experience, but for the administrator, it's just like whatever.
It's whatever craps out of
and
Drupal or something.
Yeah,
yeah,
or it's like we'll get to that later, and then you never do.
Never happens.
But of course, that, it can be really important there too, especially like to prevent errors, for example.
Definitely.
There you'll maybe want really high levels of accuracy. You'll
right.
aim for a user experience that contributes to a low error rate.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Or, you know, improved efficiency. Or, you know, lowered, like, onboarding, like, new staff experience. You know, so if you hire a new person to maintain all the copy on your website, then do you really need to spend 2 weeks, like, training them with all the different forms in the content management system?
Mm.
And then if they go away on holiday and then come back, do they remember what to do?
And, yeah. Or when the website blows up, can someone else fix it?
Yeah, what about, like, your worst experience? What could go wrong with user? Like we say, like, okay, maybe better to do a little bit of user research than not at all.
Is it always true?
Yeah.
Is it always true? Well, if you really have a good grasp already of your target audience, your target user base, then I think you can perhaps skip some of the initial research.
Discovering who the user base is.
Yeah, if you already have that, you know, maybe say you're in a startup that's been making one particular product, and in there you already did the user research, and you say, okay, that product, that's not going to fly, we're going to move to another one.
Mm-hmm.
But that's targeted at the same audience, then sure, I mean, you don't need to do it again. It's probably a good idea, though, to, as soon as you have, say, the concept, for example, to get some feedback on that. That's actually one topic of a workshop that I'll be giving sometime in the future. There are very few practical methods for evaluating concepts.
Okay.
When I say concept, I mean you've just got a narrative, for
right.
example.
Right.
There's just some basic ideas.
Mm-hmm.
It's really good to get feedback early.
Right.
Because the way I see it, user research helps save you money.
Definitely.
Because you know what to focus on, because you know the user needs and what are their pain points, and you also know you identify problems earlier or issues earlier. And the earlier you change something and correct course, it's so much cheaper.
Definitely.
If you just have a narrative or some boxes, you know those boxes you draw on paper and connected to each other with lines, those really high-level ones,
mm-hmm.
it's like 2 minutes to change that picture.
Mm-hmm.
If you've already made mock-ups
sure.
of the screen, you're talking maybe 10 minutes or maybe half an hour or maybe even a day.
Mm-hmm.
If it's already been coded...
Yeah.
You know,
months or impossible. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, depending on the architectural decisions you made at the software level, yeah,
right.
you may have to rewrite the whole thing. And if you've already launched the product, then maybe you need to pull out some feature that some people really like to use, but
right.
they're harming your product.
Mm-hmm.
Then that's a difficult decision, of course, to make.
Right.
So it's much better to find that out earlier. That's why I see we talked about what is user research before. There are basically two elements, and I boil it down to understanding and getting feedback. There's much fancier words you can use, like generative and summative and normative and formative, but I like to just stick with simple words. It's about understanding the people you're designing for and their situation, the whole environment around them, and then getting feedback on the ideas that you have for a solution.
And so have you ever had the situation where you're doing this sort of user research and you get such contradictory input that it sort of is paralyzing? Or what would you do in a situation like that?
In this case, maybe do a little bit more research to find out then why. Or maybe sometimes this can happen if you've got... if you're doing user research where there's a lot of different types of users who might have different needs, then they can appear to conflict. So then you might then decide to, say, focus on one group rather. Maybe then that's a good chance for you to focus your product offering, for example.
So if if someone's listening and they've done some user research and they get wildly differing results, try not to view it as a catastrophe or like a testing failure, maybe.
Or maybe you need to formulate better the questions you're asking.
Or target the people you're talking to.
Or redefining the problem you're trying to solve.
Right.
And I think, so we talked about this earlier, but that research is not something you do just in the beginning and you forget about it, or just at the end when everything is ready and you test your product and you say, okay, it works or not. But it's really something which is continuous and that you can do at every stage of the project.
Yeah, because even when you're doing, say, usability testing, which maybe you say it's more focused on getting feedback, when you do the usability testing, especially if you're doing it in person, you get to connect with somebody who's in your target audience. You get to find out about their life a bit more from the way that they use your product and maybe the questions that they have. And from the discussions with them, you actually also understand better their needs. And so you can do the collection of understanding feedback, like you said, Marie, at any time in the project. I just think you get the best bang for buck the earlier on you do it.
Sure.
Yeah.
Definitely. So...
still a nightmare project.
I think this is a long time ago when I'd chosen to focus on user experience. There was one person who came into the company, and he knew about user experience, especially from a theoretical point of view. Now, what had happened here, though, was a real communication failure. Because he was reviewing the user interfaces that other people in the company were making, but he wasn't with them at the time. So he would write then a long list of feedback. And, of course, this is one mistake UX people can make, which is to focus on the negatives, the things to be improved. And we don't focus on the things that are good, which we should be doing because, of course, you want to preserve them in the next iteration of the product that you're making. And what I saw happen here was he would create a long list of these are things that are wrong and here's why they're wrong, and then this is maybe how you should fix them. And those people got really annoyed, the people who'd made them, because this person wasn't there to discuss with them that there were certain decisions, of course, why they'd been designed that way, and there wasn't this dialogue. And when there isn't this dialogue between, this close dialogue between anybody giving feedback and the person who made that thing, you end up with a situation that ends up with people feeling bad.
Sure. And I think,
so
I think this
be
is
really respectful and humble, and
And I think it's also just this idea of, like, you know, communicating the good points as well. I mean, this is an experience, like, anyone who's worked in any sort of client, you know, client-contractor relationship as a creative person. Has experienced, where, you know, you have, you know, you create, I don't know, like a brand guideline for like a identity you're working on as a graphic designer, and you send it to the client, and you know, you get an email back that's like, oh, we don't like the blue and the typeface is all wrong, but, you know, really maybe that was the only two negative points they had out of all the positive things, but because they didn't write it to you, you...
Or maybe they don't know how to express it. So could you give us like some practical advice on how to get started with user research? We understand there needs to be a dialogue, it needs to be done as early as possible, as often as possible. What would be some easy technique how to start?
Yeah. Perhaps if we go back to the real basics, I would say, first of all, make sure you understand from the project that you're working on, make sure you understand the business objectives. What do they want to achieve as a business?
Mm.
Or it could be an organization.
Business?
Do you think it's possible to conciliate both the business and the user?
Well, to be blunt, the business is paying usually for the work. So the organisation or the business, you need to understand what are their goals.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And then it's good to have a kind of grasp of if technology has already been chosen, or if you're dealing with a second version and no, you're not going to change the technology, what are the basic things there, what are the basic mm-hmm. issues, and then of course the user objectives.
Right.
If you say come into a project, which has happened many times to me, and there are no, say, user stories or overall statements of how this product or service will help the user, you know, in their life, which is the person, how it will help the person in their life who's going to use the product or service, then those are really basic questions that should be answered. And I think that's actually then where it all starts. So once you have answers to that, then you can find out, okay, what do we already know about the target audience? What do we need to know that we don't know? Like, for example, I'm working on a video calling service at the moment. One thing I really like about it is they're trying to keep it really simple. And everything this company I'm working with, they've done so far, I'm really impressed it has been to keep it simple. So, for example, it'd be really nice to know what's the rough number of friends that someone would video call.
Mm-hmm. Like on the same call.
Or over a period of months, say, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So then you end up with some specific questions which may have come out from trying to do some initial designs.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can go about trying to answer those questions. In terms of really simple techniques for user research, really basic one would be finding a nice checklist and using that to review what you already have.
And that's sort of like a standing checklist that you check every time there's an update or something?
Yeah. And if you actually do it like this over time, you can see how you go over time.
Mm-hmm.
And that checklist would basically cover things like, you know, what's the navigation like? Or what's the legibility of the fonts? How easy are they to read? Or what's the consistency of different things? So if you have a nice checklist, that can actually help you just starting. And then, of course, you can then find out more about particular questions on that checklist. And the other thing to do is spend time with your users, which I don't like to use the term users, but spend time with the people who are using your product and service.
Mm-hmm.
See the context that they'd be using it in. Watch them, what they're doing. That's a really useful thing to do. It gives you such broader view.
Right, right.
It has fancier name, contextual inquiry, if any people out there want to look it up. But basically that's what it is. It's observing somebody and interviewing them, and the interviewing part is really, for me, it's trying to understand why.
Mm-hmm.
Why is somebody doing that?
Right.
And really a deep understanding of why, because maybe I've seen this especially with enterprise systems, people do particular steps that maybe they don't really need to do. We could have resolved that issue or fulfilled that need in another way, perhaps mm-hmm. even completely automatically.
Right, right.
Or we could simplify the process and there wouldn't even be that need. So I think That's why you need to be out there and asking the question. Because
in actual context.
Yeah, like if you just say, look at the analytics, that's a good example with web analytics.
Right.
You can get lots of statistics and it feels really nice because you've got these hard numbers.
Yeah, it's safe, you can rely on it. Yeah.
Which management, a lot of people in management like to see those numbers.
Sure. They have business educations.
Mm-hmm. But those numbers don't tell you why.
Exactly.
Maybe someone went down this route and maybe they don't even need to go down that route, so we don't even need to optimize it.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, that's kind of a big point a lot of people are talking about right now in the UX community is this, you know, are we relying too much on these sort of, this big data concept? People tend to think, because big data is this sort of new magical technology, that it somehow kind of holds the answers to everything. When, you might build some giant data analysis program which can, you know, deduce patterns in giant data sets where you can really get the same information by going and talking to someone for 20 minutes.
And it's cheaper even though.
So on big data, I think there's a really lovely example from one of my friends working in the television industry. And they were looking at their analytics and they saw a very distinct division in the way a certain group of people do things, the path they went through the website, and the way another group did things. And if they just stay with the analytics, they'll never know why. So what they did is they then went and visited, observed and interviewed some people from each group, and they discovered that those people were watching the streaming TV in very different ways. So some were actually just using this almost as background music. So they would actually open up the browser,
right. Go
to the TV site, and then minimize it, plug their headphones in, and continue with their working. And then if there was some interesting news story, they might look around a bit more on the website.
That's funny.
Whereas the other people they wanted to use the website in a more interactive way.
Mm-hmm.
They would come there and then they would search through. They would have a look at the news stories of the day and then maybe look from article to article. And this is something you just cannot get from the numbers.
Right.
So I think with all these, I've seen, it's the technology industry is somehow inside, it has this nature of hyping up all these different technologies.
Right.
And the UX industry also has this similar thing of hyping up different methods and tools.
Right.
And I really see that you need to understand what is the problem that you have, say the informational problem, what do you need to know, and then select the right tool.
Right.
Eye tracking is great for certain things. A/B testing is fantastic at answering certain questions.
Mm-hmm.
And interview observation research can get you answers that can almost only be going that way. And usability testing in person or remotely or maybe asynchronously through some recorded sessions, those can all do different things for you.
Mm-hmm.
It really depends on what the constraints are, who your target audience is,
and what the question is.
Yeah, so that's where you really need to begin with these
right.
tools.
But it's great to hear, kind of like you're almost kind of like more like goal oriented rather than kind of tool oriented. But yeah,
when you want some information, you will just pick up the tool that would work best.
Right.
But the important is what comes out in the
end. Exactly. I think we definitely live in many ways in sort of like a shiny things bubble. You know, it doesn't matter like what you're doing. Like if you're at all involved in sort of like the digital world, it's like every facet of the digital world is just like, you know, exponentially expanding. You know, it's almost every week I read about some, like, new user testing thing where, like, you know, you can automatically, like, do this thing with this JavaScript thing or, you know, usertesting.com and you send them a link and then they have a face recording of some dude, like, using your website. And so it's like you see, you have this sort of stream of constantly kind of new stuff, like, oh, I want to try that, I want to try that. But, yeah, without asking those fundamental questions of, like, is this the right tool for this
Why?
Situation, right? Or is this even, like, a thing we need to test?
Yeah.
It's really easy to kind of get sucked into that hole of, ooh, look at this service. Let's look at this service.
I'm actually going through this situation right now in the last few days because, well, one client I'm working with, they keep pushing a prototyping tool to me and they say, Ming, have a look at this. And I look at it and I'm like, yeah, okay. So you can do wireframing with it. There are hundreds of tools to do that.
Mm-hmm.
What is it that you actually want?
Yeah.
You know? So then I've said to them, okay, that looks good, okay, but what do we want to use it for? You know, what part of our communication process do we need to improve for me working with you guys?
Right.
And how would the prototyping help us? What do you want to get out of it?
Right.
Do you just want all of us maybe to contribute to building that wireframe and then have a way to communicate that with the developers?
Mm-hmm.
Or do you want to build a full-on interactive prototype? Mm-hmm. And if so, for what platforms? You know, these are questions that you need to answer.
But it's shiny.
Yes. So now I've gone and created a Google spreadsheet there and I've put in there what I see as requirements from my perspective for the prototyping tool that I'm using when working with them, which may be different to when I'm working with another client.
Sure,
the needs. So I've now put that in there and I've said, okay, here's what I think of the requirements.
Right.
Like, we need to have good real-time remote collaboration possibility.
Mm-hmm.
That means in real time I can edit something and you'll see the change.
Right.
You can even see what I'm selecting, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Do we need to be able to use it offline or not? That's an open requirement for discussion.
Mm-hmm.
Do we need to be able to export that somewhere else?
Right.
You know, how locked in do we want to be, like, to some of these services?
Mm-hmm.
That's how they can keep you, because if you can't export
your
information well, then you're locked into the service. So, like, you know, how important is that to us? Maybe it's not, because we're just going to make it and then it's just a communication tool which exists until we've developed the product.
Mm-hmm.
And then we don't really care about it.
Right.
But if we're going to need to revisit that prototype, we'll need to keep updating that, perhaps.
Right.
So there's so many...
Make sure it's not a pre-funding startup from
something. So there's so many tools and methods out there that when people just say, you know, what's the best one?
Right.
There's no answer.
How long's a piece of string, Ming?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So tell us what project you're passionate about at the moment, or something that you are about to do, some vision you have for the future of your own activity.
Mm. There's two streams I have. One is the user research side.
Mm-hmm.
I'm doing particular things to help people understand that user research isn't this big scary thing, that they can start very simply and get some better understanding of the people they're making their products for and also easily get their feedback. So that's one thing I'm doing. So it's an educational side. So there's a blog I'm working on, and there's whenever there's an opportunity at a conference or to give a lecture or a workshop, these are things I'm doing to share that knowledge.
Right.
Especially, say, there's this new method that I explained to evaluate concepts, which is very useful because there hasn't been anything. So these kind of things I want people to know that they're out there, that they can just take them and start using them. You know, they're not copyrighted. They're not.
Right.
That's the great thing, these processes. You know, you can't patent this process.
Right.
That's a really great thing about, I guess, the UX industry. In terms of client work, I'm working, as I said, for this client who's doing video calling to targeted mania connecting families, and they really are keeping the product simple. So I really enjoy working with them because we have the same view. And they're not just saying that. They actually are doing that.
Right.
They're making decisions that let's leave that out. You know, they're really focusing on the core.
That's cool.
So I really enjoy doing that. And that's also on Android TV, which is a pretty new platform and with new ways of doing things. So it's actually kind of interesting to go back in some ways, that there's this four-way up, down, left, right controller and focus, no touch at all.
Right.
But at the same time, it's using Google's material design.
Mm-hmm.
So it's looking forward for that, and then say with animations, looking at how you can use the animations to add meaning, mm-hmm. not just some eye candy.
Right.
Which I see as a real risk actually with animations.
Sure, it'll die down.
Like the blink tag.
Yeah, like I said, we're sort of in the shiny things kind of phase of this new technology. Mm. And with Android TV, do you think that voice is going to be a big part of that, or?
I think it will be a significant part of it in terms of the input mechanism. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, like when you want to, say, search for something, it's much easier if the voice recognition works accurately enough that you can then, instead of having to type something
in. Sure, on your remote control.
So I think that's a good side of it, but I think actually Google's done a pretty good job with keeping the initial Android TV UI pretty simple.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite optimized at browsing content, and it provides some room for the, I'm not sure who it is controlling it, but for somebody to be, you know, pushing content and rearranging, say, the order of things.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a pretty easy experience for people coming in and browsing, you know, just to try out and watch, you know, YouTube videos. And I think what it's doing, from what I see, is it's looking at what I watch and then, of course, suggesting some related things like...
Robots.
Yeah, like now it's suggesting all these material design things to me because I watch just a few.
Oh, no, I get my YouTube recommendations are hilarious. It's like Peppa Pig and Sesame Street and, like, AngularJS tutorials.
Nice. Yeah, one last anecdote. I remember in one of your lectures you showed that picture of a blacksmith and a guy dressed with pink wings on his back. Could you tell us a bit more about that? Just what does it represent for you in the context of user research?
So as this is a podcast, just to clarify that image in the listeners' minds, there's a slide there in my lecture or presentation where there's the blacksmith,
mm-hmm.
and there's that person with the wings is the assistant.
The apprentice.
The apprentice.
Mm-hmm.
And this slide, the pink wings are there to attract people's attention, right? But the master-apprentice relationship is really what I wanted to focus on, mm-hmm. in that slide. And that's the way, that's describing the approach to adopt when you're, say, doing an observation interview. It's really that you're there to learn,
mm-hmm.
as the apprentice from a master, from someone who's been doing their job for a long time, for someone who's been living their life for, you know, gosh knows how many years,
mm-hmm.
and your place isn't to question that what they're doing is wrong or to try and change it at this stage. your aim here is to find out really why are they doing those things and really to learn from them and not suggest that they change particular things, at least not at the outset, because as soon as you do that, you bias them and they think, oh, maybe they don't want to hear that,
mm-hmm.
maybe I shouldn't say those things. So you really want to be a humble apprentice who's learning from a master about how they work, live, or play, or study in that particular area of focus that you have, that you're researching.
I think this is maybe one area that is probably really difficult for quite a lot of designers. So if you're a designer and you're listening to this podcast, hi. but you know, if you attended a traditional design school, then you kind of know the way that, you know, traditionally designers are taught, is that you are sort of the master of, like, this thing you're creating. And the people have to like it because you're a designer and you said it was good. And so I think it's really divergent kind of mindset, what you're describing, from how traditional design is taught. You know, we're taught, like, you know, we do have this really rigorous training to learn aesthetics and to learn design principles and to learn how to create something which is beautiful and functional. And so naturally, like, you feel like you are the expert. And so it's really easy to, like, you know, put a lot of thought into something as a designer, put it in front of someone, you know, a client or an end user, and then interpret negative reactions by saying, like, oh, well, that was, like, a really stupid person. you know, so, or like, will you just don't understand, or having some sort of rationale for why the person had a negative reaction, you know. And so, again, that's like, you know, like this apprentice thing you're talking about is basically you take your own expertise and you have to like pretend like it doesn't exist actually.
Yeah, I guess I see this. I mean, I've worked with some people who have very strong egos, particularly, say, and it's often in the visual, you know, when I'm working with a visual designer, it can be like this. I see the way to work with this situation is, okay, why are we doing, why are we even working on this project?
What are the goals, right?
Yeah, so that's why I said earlier on, that's why you need the objectives, because I see the way is to, okay, those are the objectives, how are we going to get there? One way to get there is to just make something and see if it flies.
Mm-hmm.
That's a perfectly valid way of doing things, especially if you've got the money to do that and try
it. Right.
But you can also find out a little bit. I think, so focusing on those goals, those actual goals that are outside of yourself, the way to be less egoistic, I guess, is a bit more challenging, though.
Mm-hmm.
I guess you need to kind of let go of your design.
Right.
And let go of the precious baby that you've created.
Yeah, yeah.
Which can mean it's actually much easier for someone else
mm-hmm.
to then present your design,
right.
And ask for that feedback from someone.
Right.
Because that someone, that person is more neutral.
Right.
And then maybe you can either watch that through a live video stream or you can look at the video recording.
Mm-hmm.
And then you might be a bit surprised at how people interpret things in different ways.
Exactly.
And I guess I think the other thing is not to view it as a, you know, I've sometimes wondered, it's a philosophical question, you know, what is failure?
Mm-hmm.
Is it, what is it actually, and do we have to look at it so negatively?
Right.
I would see that if a designer makes something, they've put, you know, blood, sweat and tears into it, which everyone does. They want to do a good job. Mm-hmm. I think most people want to do a good job. They do a good job and then they get some feedback that's, oh, we should change this and this. To me, that's a learning thing. It's about, okay, great, now I know this, I can make it even better and I can use all my expertise to interpret that feedback, combine it with what I know from the design point of view, from what I know from the developers, what's easy to do, what's different, you know, what takes them a long time to program. And then that, to me, that's a really challenging problem, you know. Okay, so mm-hmm. how do we move from, with this feedback, how do we take this feedback and then change the design? To me, that's, if you can do that, I mean, that's a great designer who
definitely,
can do that.
Definitely. Yeah. And I think those are, unfortunately, skills which are hard to judge in a portfolio.
I think when I was more of an employee before, some of the best questions I remember having, which I remember reflecting back on things there, they were really good questions to ask, are more, you know, looking at how you think
mm-hmm.
and maybe even how you do react to criticism.
Right, right.
You know? Like, you know, if you put someone then in a situation where they've got, you give them a hypothetical situation and you say, how would you resolve it? And then you also see how they react if you say those parts are good, but what about this? Because I see this issue in it.
Mm-hmm.
You can see how they react.
So right.
I think it all gets back to, you know, I talked about the success situations and the nightmare situations.
Right, right.
If you look at those situations, it's actually all about communication.
Definitely.
Yeah.
So a big, you know, people ask me what I do. The biggest part of my day-to-day, you know, when there's someone who actually asks me, what do you do day-to-day, Ming? Most of the time, I'm actually discussing with people,
mm-hmm.
trying to work out what do they want, whether it's the business, whether it's the end user, whether it's the developer, you know, what do they want? What would make
right.
their life easier? And
well, thanks for discussing with
yeah.
us and sharing all that. Today's really, really interesting and... just before we wrap it up, tell us where we can find your work or where the audience can get in touch with you.
So we've recently just launched a website. It's called Rexperienced. So that's Re-Experienced, REXPERIENCED.com. I'm sure you'll be linking it from your podcast.
Yes, we'll put it in the show notes.
So that's a site that's quite new, and we don't have too much on there, but we will be adding more content to there. So through there, you can get in contact with me or just search for Ming Lee Helsinki.
Cool. And so this, just to clarify, this Rexperienced site, it's you're planning to do kind of more like UX training and talking about topics in UX and education, or?
Yeah, so in there, I'm a very practical person. So the kind of posts that I'll be writing in there are, here's some information I've found out or I've learned through my years of experience, and here's how I think I can help you. So, like, for example, start user research today. What are three things, what are three easy methods that you could start using? With the Android TV project I've been working on,
mm-hmm.
I'd like to put in there information about how does a UX person move to a completely new platform. Now, as UX people, we're actually focused on human beings, on people. So maybe moving to a new platform shouldn't be such an issue, but I know people can tend to get even stereotyped as, you know, that's the person who makes mobile apps, or that's the person who makes great websites. So
cool.
That transition. Yeah.
Cool. Yeah, so thanks for the great discussion.
Thank you very much.
Thank you too.
So now we've covered the empathy phase. You have a little bit more of an idea of what it takes to get to know your user, to get to know your user's pain, and get an idea for how you can address their issues with design. So what's next?
So next time we'll discuss how to define a design question or opportunity from this user information, user research, and see really what questions are worth solving and how to formulate them.
So we hope you found this episode interesting, and if you'd like to send us your own stories about user research, just send us an email to hellobrunchworks@gmail.com, and we'll include your insight in the next episode. If you love this and want to share it with more people, be sure to rate us on iTunes, share the podcast with anyone you think might be interested, and subscribe to our newsletter at brunchworks.co.
Thanks, and speak to you soon.